Well, in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Despite U.S. migration law and despite law enforcement efforts, thousands of illegal Mexican immigrants arrive in the U.S. each year. About 400,000 legal and illegal immigrants enter the U.S. annually. On the program today, we look into the Mexican immigration debate. Our guest is journalist Peter Laufer. He says U.S. policy is counterproductive, doesn't work, and is costly. And he says if it did work, it would harm our economy. He says our economy depends on the Mexican workforce. So he says, open the U.S.-Mexican border. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Peter Laufer, is the author of 7 books. His latest is Wetback Nation, the case for opening the Mexican-American border. Peter has reported from Mexico and the U.S.-Mexican border for more than 20 years as an NBC News correspondent and as a freelance writer. His work has received several honors, including the Polk, Murrow, and National Headliner Awards. Again, the number to call if you'd like to join us this afternoon, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Peter Laufer, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be on your show, Celeste. Thank you for having me.
Sure. One of the questions you must be asked all the time and right up front, if the border was open, wouldn't the U.S. be deluged with people coming north from Mexico?
And the answer to that question, and you are quite correct, it's asked all the time, is the U.S. is deluged with people coming up from Mexico. And consequently, as I've studied this problem and tried to figure out what might work to ameliorate it, what occurs to me seems remarkably simple and straightforward, and in fact is in some ways counterintuitive, because it will work to secure the border, and that is to welcome Mexicans who are coming up anyway and regularize their attendance in this country. And what's key here is that what I'm saying is Mexicans. The bulk of the people coming into this country are Mexicans, and the bulk of those Mexicans we want in this country. The bulk of the people we don't want in this country are not Mexicans. So if we allow Mexicans to come into this country with the same kind of freedom that we allow Canadians to come into this country, then we would have a chance at securing the border. But under the current circumstances, the chaos on the border is such that not only are these Mexicans that we want in here getting into the country, but who knows who else is getting in.
Hmm. You know, I cited in my introduction the number 400,000 legal and illegal immigrants enter the U.S. annually. Can you sort that out for us a little bit in terms of how many legal immigrants are in the country and how many illegal immigrants are?
Well, that's part of the fascinating aspect of this story and part of the crisis of this story, Celeste. We can't answer that because we simply don't know. And the what's now called the Homeland Security Department, and a lot of the acronyms and names have changed, but what we're used to calling the INS and the MIGRA, the Department of the government that's in charge of trying to keep track of this, comes up with the numbers that they use for estimates based on their arrests. and then they extrapolate from there. But in fact, it's an unknown number. We know that there are millions of Mexicans in this country who have come in over the last several years and are here without proper documentation, illegally, wetbacks, whatever one wants to call them. They are here by coming across as migrants that don't pay attention to the rules that would keep them out if they tried to come through legally.
Hmm. You use that word wetback in the title of your book, Wetback Nation, and it's seen as a derogatory word. What led you to use it here?
I suppose in part to take advantage of the fact that that's considered a derogatory word and look at what we're doing. I use it to point to the negative actions that I perceive the U.S. government is taking that's creating this wetback nation. And that the pejorative is on us. It's on Americans for allowing this to happen, to create an environment that draws Mexicans to this country illegally and consequently puts them into a position of an underclass and creates that which is used negatively against them, that word wetback.
Yeah, that's part of the problem, isn't it?
It's absolutely part of the problem because there are two laws at work here. There's the law that the Mexicans are violating by coming north without documentation, without going through the border controls. And then there's the equal law that the employers are violating by hiring them. And of course, if the employers were not hiring them, these people, the bulk of them, would not come. This is an economic-driven migration. These aren't people who are coming up here because they would prefer the winters in Illinois to the winters in Oaxaca.
Yeah. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Chicago on the toll-free line, Line 4. Let's go and talk with our listener. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. You're quite right that it's an economic thing. Unfortunately, I think people like you, as well as the right wing, put the entire issue in moral terms and ignore the fundamental economics of it. Neither the Democratic Party or the Republican Party has ever shown any interest at all in stopping illegal immigration. This is a tool that has historically, from the early days when the first influx of Germans came in the 1850s through the Irish immigrations, has always been a tool used by large corporations to drive wages down in America, as it is being done now. When you can get somebody who is really desperate from an extremely poor situation, you can always pit them against people who expect to be paid whatever you might call a minimum wage. These people will work for even less. And unfortunately, I think both sides of the debate always want to approach this from a moral issue. Either they hate the swarthy foreigners, or they love them. But nobody wants to really say, and you know, this is a situation now, I think, in your case, where as a pseudo-leftist, you're completely in bed with big capital on this issue. They love desperate people.
I don't quite understand the two attacks here. So
wait,
far,
wait.
You're telling me that I ignore the economics when, in fact, I brought it up. And it certainly, if you take a look at the book, Wetback Nation, you'll find it riddled with these economic realities that you're addressing. And the pseudo-leftist is a little odd, but of course, you're welcome to call me what you wish.
Yeah, okay.
I think you give lip service to the economics and don't really want to do anything about it. If you really cared about it, you would be writing a book on insisting that labor laws are enforced in America.
Well, that's your solution. What's your solution?
I just said it make the government enforce labor laws across the board. Shut down these employers
when Celeste and I were just talking about the double lawbreaking that's going on. The Mexicans coming north, and the employers are violating the laws that exist, and were those employers not violating those laws, the Mexicans would not be coming north.
Yeah, this caller, though, represents a part of the debate.
No question.
You know, if it's a labor issue, and his take on it is a little different than other takes that I've heard on it. I mean, some people are afraid for their jobs. You know, if we allow Mexicans north, then our wages will go down or we'll lose jobs.
Well, it's terrifically complex. There's that aspect of it, too. of course, and then there's also what happens to the costs of goods and services if, in fact, this kind of a labor structure that the caller was suggesting were in place. How much are you willing to pay for apples and oranges or janitorial services or gardening services? Again, I'm not making a judgment here. I'm raising the issue. But how much are you in Champaign, Urbana, in Chicago, wherever, willing to pay for these things? What kinds of price structures do you want that would enable the employers to pay the kinds of wages that somebody not coming up from Mexico desperate would accept in order to do some of these jobs?
Yeah. I want to keep on the question of economics here for a bit. The director of American University Center for North American Studies in Washington, Robert Pastor, was quoted recently in the Christian Science Monitor as saying that we're not going to make progress until the development gap between Mexico and the U.S. is reduced. And he says the income gap has widened since NAFTA. Now, another person that you write about in your book who sees a development gap is a congressman from Texas, Silvestre Reyes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no question that we have a fascinating and bizarre and complex problem with this migration that is equaled nowhere else in the world. This is the only place, the Mexican-U.S. border, where the first world and the third world meet on a land border. And consequently, these kinds of problems that you just talked about, Celeste, exist in each other's faces. We are in each other's faces, and this gap continues and arguably gets worse. As long as that's the case, as long as Mexico has a political system that is so corrupt and consequently an economy that is so underperforming, and as long as the U.S. wants workers who are working cheap, then this problem is going to exist. So the question that I keep going back to and that I addressed in the book, to the dismay of your caller, is what do we do about the current problem while we look to address these larger geopolitical, economic issues? We've got a crisis on the border of consequence. And if we accept the fact that we are unsuccessful at keeping Mexicans out, and in fact, we want those Mexicans in, when I say we want them in, I mean the overall American pattern right now, then it makes sense to me to just let them in and keep all the rest of the people that we clearly don't want in out, who can be coming across that border now, whether they be so-called terrorists or drug pushers or common criminals or whoever they are. There are a bunch of people that can come in the shadows of these Mexican workers that we could keep out if we allowed the Mexican workers in without trouble.
Hmm. How so? I mean, talk with us a little bit more about how that would be possible.
Well, right now what you have are hordes of people coming north across this no man's land, this free-for-all that is this artificial border between the two countries. And this is every night, every day, constantly, and it is completely out of control, and it's mostly Mexicans who are coming across. Now, we're also not talking here about the humanitarian tragedy of the people who are sick and dying crossing that border, preyed on by rapists and robbers and weather. That's an aspect of the story that is also important. But we're just talking now about the people coming north. Most of these people are Mexicans. But because it's out of control, because the Border Patrol cannot control it or chooses not to, there are those who suggest militarizing the border and that we could accomplish a sealed border if we had the political will. That's questionable, but even if that is the case, right now that's not happening. So people are coming across. It's wide open. Most of these people are desperate workers coming across looking for jobs. But in their shadows, in their midst, are who knows who. These drug pushers, terrorists, people smugglers, all kinds of baddies that you certainly don't want in here. So if you allow the car wash operators, the gardeners, the janitors, the fruit and vegetable pickers to come up in a regularized manner, then the numbers go down so consequentially that the Border Patrol is in a position, Celeste, to be able to then control what's left. With the manpower that they have and the technology that they have, then they can stop those who are not coming through the regular borders.
Hmm. The folks in the Border Patrol that you've interviewed over the years, what do they think? What do they think about your idea to open the border?
Well, they generally don't think that that's the solution, because their political orientation is to have a controlled border and to keep people out who are not supposed to be coming in according to current laws and regulations. It's the refrain, what part of illegal don't you understand, is the rejoinder on that. But they certainly agree that it's out of control now, because they see it closer than any of us do. And it is such an eye-opener to take a ride along with any of these Border Patrol units. Some of your listeners might want to consider that as a vacation alternative to Puerto Vallarta sometime, and just arrange to spend a day or two with the Border Patrol and see what they go through, a situation where they are completely ill-equipped in manpower and technology, despite the huge numbers that they have and the equipment that they have, to combat this crush forward.
Mm. Would it be fair to say that, in general, they think that the system works or could work, it's just overloaded?
I don't think so. I think that it's fair to say that anybody looking at it realizes that economic-driven migration historically is unstoppable, and borders historically are one can't make them secure unless there is a will of the people for them to be secure. Even if you look at something as egregious as the Berlin Wall and East Germany, some of the tightest controlled borders ever in history, those were violated by people. And so certainly a situation here where you have both the push and the pull, it's a problem created by both sides. We want them up here. They want to come up here. That's not something that you can control. Add to the mix the wild nature of the land in Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, and the eastern part of the California border, and there's no way to stop this.
Mm.
We're proving that now. It's not stoppable. It's not stoppable politically. It's not stoppable on the ground by a police force. We need to figure out a way to deal with the problems that's causing. And dealing with it by saying, let's not let them in here anymore, isn't going to work, because they're coming in here. We already are saying, let's not let them in here.
When and why were controls put into place along our southern border?
Oh, a long time ago, controls were put in, beginning of the 20th century. The controls started not to keep Mexicans out, but to keep people from Asia and Europe out, who were using Mexico to circumvent the restrictions that existed for their migration. And then slowly, for various reasons, we made attempts to control the population from coming in from Mexico. It's important to remember, and again, I'm thinking about your caller who suggested my title should be pseudo-liberal, but it's important to remember that this half of Mexico, that is California, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and other portions of other states, we took from Mexico in a war that we started in a manner not unlike the way we started the war in Iraq. And consequently, there's no history of a border there. And even after that war was won by the United States and Mexico ceded all of this territory, there was initially an opportunity for the people in those ceded territories to decide whether they wanted to be U.S. citizens or Mexican citizens and go back to the part of Mexico that was not under the control of the United States. And since that time, the movement back and forth has been continuous. Now, one of the interesting post-September 11th developments, Celeste, is that because the crossing is more difficult now and more expensive to be ushered by a smuggler, a lot of people who commuted essentially up to this country to do work and then went home are finding it more expeditious to stay up here. It's another example of policy being counterproductive. So the policy is increasing the permanent undocumented or illegal residency of Mexicans in this country. And it's also creating permanent or quasi-permanent splits of families because the workers come up here and can't rationalize the danger of making a return trip when their job is over if they're doing seasonal work such as harvesting.
Hmm. You mentioned September 11th, but in the 90s there were also concerns about illegal immigration, and that also was a landmark period there. Was it 1996, 1994?
Yeah, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe it was 96 when there was the most recent change to the immigration law, another one in the 80s. You're absolutely right. This has been continuous since the early part of the 20th century when border controls were first put into place. There was the period of the so-called braceros, which was a guest worker plan, not unlike what President Bush is proposing now, which resulted in abuses of the Mexican workers by employers in this country and then consequently resulted in abuses of the border controls by Mexicans looking to work around the official program. This has been a continual problem, and it is a problem of labor and capital, as the caller suggested. It needs to be addressed ultimately, as you suggested, Celeste, based on the disparity in the economies and the political systems of the two countries. But in the meantime, the de facto result should not be what we have now, which is an out-of-control, chaotic border.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today is journalist Peter Laufer. He is the author most recently of Wetback Nation, The Case for Opening the Mexican-American Border. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon, join the discussion with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, if it would be a long distance call, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi, are you familiar with the assimilation of the Mexican Americans into the city of Chicago and the economic benefits brought to that city?
Well, I like to think so, but I want to hear from you.
Well, 35 years ago, the area around Cermak and Cicero, 26th Street, that area was really a very run-down, impoverished area that had no, that was really a blight on the city of Chicago and was causing them a lot of grief. Now it's a very vibrant community that's 90-95% Mexican-American and it has to be contributing just tons of money into the city in the form of sales taxes and jobs and everything else. Anybody goes down there at all just has to be amazed at the vibrancy of that community, and it's all Mexican-American.
Absolutely, and we see, and in fact, President Fox visited there several months ago, and we see similar situations throughout the country, and we see that historically with immigration and the success of immigration in this country. And it's another reason why the influx of people from Mexico should not be feared.
That's very true. And what's happened in that neighborhood is that becomes the first place they migrate into. And then as they work into better jobs and raise their standards of living and all, now you're seeing the Mexican communities moving out into Arlington Heights and Palatine and up into the north side and all over, and you're getting this lending where they're working their way into the normal American-type cities and on and away from just their Mexican neighborhoods, but where they, just like other nationalities have done, the history of the United States.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's a theme that's addressed with great humor in the film A Day Without a Mexican, which perhaps you've seen, and it deals with the idea that California wakes up and there are no Mexicans in California anymore, and one sees then through this film how thoroughly Mexicans are contributing to the society and the economy.
That's right. Well, thank you.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Hello. What do you make of the fact that right-wing talk radio, the Sean Hannitys, Rush Limbaughs, etc., are always, always going on and on and on about illegal immigration. Illegal immigration. This must be stopped. Whereas, being right-wing Republicans, they seem to represent the business interests who want cheap labor and are thus aiding and abetting the Mexican immigrants coming across.
Well, I think it's an example of the absurdity of that kind of radio. It's funny that you mentioned that, because just before you called, I was thinking about the reasoned approach that Celeste takes with this program, even with the delivery, and I was conscious of the fact that I'm speaking to all of you over this radio station and with Celeste in a much calmer tone, in a more reasoned manner than I often end up speaking when I am a guest on those types of shows that you mentioned, because they are so built on trying to rile the audience. And I think that more than trying to find the arguments in those shows, the reality is that they are built to draw audience by creating paranoia and dissent. And I think that that's what's going on there, much more than some kind of a contradiction in their arguments and their points of view. They're carnival acts.
Well, certainly there is drama in conflict.
Yes, and absolutely. If we wished to disagree here, we probably would raise our voices.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana Line 3. Hi.
Yeah, I have a quote and then a couple of comments. The quote is, your guest probably knows about this, I have great misgivings about these immigrants because of their clannishness, their little knowledge of English, their press, and the increasing need of interpreters. I suppose in a few years, interpreters will also be needed in the Congress to tell one half of our legislators what the other half say. And most people would think it's, you know, somebody like Samuel Huntington, but that was actually Benjamin Franklin about German immigrants, which hopefully people out there would realize just how unfounded this kind of mass hysteria is. But
we've had it, as one of the other callers suggested, over and over and over again with the immigrant patterns in this country, and whoever is coming now, that's who the Rush Limbaughs and the Sean Hannitys want to yell about, and that's been the case for a couple of hundred years, as you point out.
Yeah, I had two points that I don't hear very often, having in relation to this immigration thing, and I want to, apparently because there's such hot topics. I mean, nobody wants to get near them. But one is, I've heard several Social Security administrators mention, usually on talk shows, like say on C-SPAN, that there are billions of dollars collected from illegals who use false Social Security numbers.
Absolutely, and that money is then never distributed
exactly to
them, and so consequently it's in money into the Treasury that is on the plus side with no outgoing to the person who's supposed to be the beneficiary.
Absolutely, and we're not talking small numbers here. Over the years, it's accumulated to something over, I think it was $340 billion that have accumulated in the Social Security trust funds, that are not being directed to the states in particular for alleviating the problems they have with illegals, which I gather are truly real. But not even they're not even being directed toward the Mexican-Americans that are here. For example, the U of I apparently is seeing a decline in minority enrollment of 14% this year. And the other thing I wanted to bring up that most people don't bring up, and which is very touchy around here, is that there are billions of dollars being spent supporting our farmers in subsidies, and it has a direct effect on the livelihoods of poor Mexicans and others in Latin America who are thrown out, you know, cannot make a livelihood any longer because they cannot compete against our products. And then we have the gall to try to stop them at the border when they try to survive. I mean, the whole thing about the subsidies and our country's attitude toward any kind of developing country about quite the contrary about helping them is to you know, to make money from them if we can, using their desperation as a tool.
Well, that definitely is something that I point out in the book, and I'm glad to hear you bring it up, especially in Illinois, where you do have such a farming base, and that is that there are minimalistic farmers in the interior of Mexico who absolutely fit your model, and they're finding that the corn that they grow can no longer sustain them because the prices of the imported post-NAFTA corn coming from up here, the prices are so low that there just is no no way for them to compete.
Yeah. Well, I just you know, I'd really love to hear an honest attempt to address both of those issues, but I'm afraid that with the leadership we've got on both in both parties, that we'll never see it. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Peter Laufer, author of Wetback Nation, The Case for Opening the Mexican-American Border. Our guest this afternoon believes that, he says, U.S. policy is counterproductive. It doesn't work, and it's costly. And he says if it did work, it would harm our economy. And so he says, open up the U.S.-Mexican border. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. The caller raised a number of points, and I think one of the things that the two of you talked about gets the question off the table, would social services in this country, would they be able to handle the increased demands placed on them in terms of schools, health care, and the like? And I think we can take that question off the table. But I do want to go back to the idea of, I think something that he raised in his comments, the caller, reminded me of the security concerns that some folks have. And this motivates some folks, like you read about a fellow by the name of Chris Simcox in the book, motivates him to take on this question. And, you know, he's one of these grassroots groups, some would call vigilantes, who, you know, are bound and determined to seal the border.
Well, Chris Simcox and many of the others also, but Chris Simcox, he's the fellow I profile in the book, is probably more of a personal opportunist than he is a deep thinker or even a vigilante, and he has seized on this issue to draw attention to himself and to try to build up his weekly newspaper in Arizona with circulation from outside Tombstone, the city or the crossroads where he operates. But it's definitely a problem, and in fact, this next month in April, there is supposedly going to be an organization of consequence amongst these vigilante groups to put people on the border in greater numbers to supposedly watch and alert the Border Patrol of intruders. Not that the Border Patrol needs any help. They know where the intruders are. But this is a problem that has all kinds of immediate potential for disaster. Some of the people coming across illegally, as we've discussed, include drug smugglers, people smugglers, common criminals. These are armed people. These are dangerous people. And if some of these vigilante types who are operating on the border get injured, killed, it's going to create just further political consequences to this problem. In addition, it adds to the chaos along the border. I spent some time, and it's addressed in the book, with a fellow who lives right on the border, and he discusses just his daily routine, what a mess it is because of the people coming across his property, because of the fact that he can't call the Border Patrol for help. They're too far away, and he finds it necessary to sit in his house at leisure with a gun by his side. To add to this mix, people coming in from outside playing cops and robbers by putting themselves in the position of some sort of pseudo border patrol is a recipe for disaster.
Let's talk with another listener caller in Indiana on line one. Hello.
Hello. Until you mention that, I have a question, but in some ways I'm glad we don't have the past secretary in the Department of Justice. The other fellow's going to be bad enough, but the other one probably would have figured out some way legally, at least for a period of time, to allow these kinds of groups to monitor the border, would be my guess. Whether he pulled it off or not, I don't know. But my question was sort of a general speculative one. I agree with practically everything you say and have been for quite some time, but, you know, there's a small percentage, I think, of us. In terms of policy and how you would try to answer the debate in Congress, what would be your general position and usually some of the quote-unquote facts brought up for the right side, how would you handle those?
Well, let's take it in as simple a way as we possibly can. Let's accept the fact that people are coming across anyway. Let's accept the fact that, in general, we want them, or we wouldn't be turning a blind eye to the laws that employers are breaking on this side by employing them. So if we regularize this, if we come up with an acceptable form of identification for a Mexican who wants to come into this country, and a Mexican who wants to come into this country just comes up to a border station, and they show this acceptable form of identification, and they are then logged in some manner so that we know who they are and that they're here, not that we can necessarily keep track of them, but we know who they are and that they're here and that they've met some minimal standard of identification and acceptance, then they come up here and they go to work. And that allows us to then keep out anybody who can't meet that standard. It's going to be hard for somebody from Afghanistan who's trying to sneak in here to do some harm to this country to show that they're a Mexican. And of course, there's going to be an argument here against that, saying that this identification could be counterfeited. Of course it can. And some people will still be able to sneak in here. But the bulk of the problem on the border, the vast majority of it, will end because of these two factors. We're letting the Mexicans in then in a regularized fashion that are coming in anyway, and it's allowing us to use the Border Patrol personnel and equipment to keep out those that we don't want in.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Morton Grove on line two. Hi.
Hi. Yes, my question has two parts. The first question is, my understanding was, and maybe you can explain why it hasn't happened, my understanding was that NAFTA was to be mutually beneficial for the U.S. and Mexico, and that in turn that would stop the Macadoros along the border. This would provide employment, etc. And it was seen in the mid-80s, along with the allowing citizenship to those who were in the country in 86. All of this seems to have been designed to help and alleviate the situation and, frankly, help Mexico as part of NAFTA. And we don't see that happening, and at the same time, China, several thousand miles away, their economy is chugging right along. So the question, I guess what I'm saying is, what happened? We seem to have had, or was programmed to all of the major networks that these are solutions to the problem. And the economic development, obviously, is not taking place down there. It's going over to China. And I don't know how much it was, maybe between 5 and 10 million people became citizens just because they were here. So it didn't solve the problem. So I guess that's why I'm asking the question, what went wrong with all this thinking that was thought to be a solution while China's going gangbusters?
Well, NAFTA was so thoroughly flawed. NAFTA was supporting free flow of capital, but not free flow of labor.
Yes.
And NAFTA allowed for, and critics would say was designed to, draw the capital down to Mexico in order to take advantage of the cheaper labor. And that's why, as you point out, it's not just that China is going gangbusters, it's that China has much cheaper labor, and so Mexico is losing out again by that work going to China and to other places in Asia where the labor is cheaper than in Mexico. If there are attempts made to see what are the differences between the European community and what we're building in North America, and what are the successes in Europe and the flaws in the American model, certainly one of the most distinct is that the European community allows for free flow of labor. And the NAFTA does not address that, and so we continue to have this problem of the gross disparity of income along with the illegal migration and immigration. Of course, it's important to point out that there's a lot of fault lies with Mexico. Mexico has this twisted political reality that allows for the endemic corruption that ruins its economy. Mexico should not be a poor country.
Well, I just was trying to contrast the success with China. In spite of all the additional transportation costs associated with their products, and that was business that should have went to Mexico. I mean, if that's where the labor was and was willing to work at a reasonable rate, and it was supposed to, as an aside, help with the immigration problem. I don't see it's come true.
No, it hasn't. And those plants are closing. They're not closing because of any laws of NAFTA. They're closing because the work is going to Asia where the labor is cheaper.
Yeah, I agree with you. That seems to be what's happening. And with the currency, with the China not really being valued correctly, they have an edge over Mexico. And nobody, you know, it's like a tri-corner thing. Nobody sees the relationship between that and the attempts that have been made over the years. And I'll get off the phone and let some other people talk. It just seems to me like it can't be seen just in isolation with North America.
You're absolutely correct.
Yeah. Okay, well, I won't trouble you any further. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. That reminds me of a chapter that you've got in your book, Peter, and that is, you know, what is a border? You know, in this world, we talk a lot about globalization, and I don't know, borders are problematic.
No question, Celeste. And they're problematic because they're changing. The fact that commerce can occur across borders via the Internet, the fact that communication can occur across borders via the Internet and telephone and radio and television, the fact that historically economic-driven migration has been essentially unstoppable, and now because of transportation developments, it's even harder to control. And when you add that to the fact that we are sharing this land border with this third world country, all of that speaks to this question, what is a border?
Hmm. The amount of money illegal immigrants send back to Mexico exceeds foreign investment and aid. And, you know, it has been proposed that the U.S. and Canada help Mexico reverse the development gap. Has that idea gained any ground, or are we actually seeing a system where it is the illegal immigrants who are doing what they can to reverse the development gap?
Well, they're certainly contributing, and you see that when you go back into Mexico and see developments on a micro basis. When a worker takes you to his family house and says, see this television, see this room is what I was able to build from working for 4 months in Indiana last year. And again, despite my differences with the first caller that you had on the air today, what he said is so true, that this is a question of capital. As long as we want in this country the cheap labor, as long as we demand that cheap labor, then these people are going to come up here. And the fact that the disparity between the two countries is so great means that this money they make is going to get shipped back to family and friends and is going to have this consequential impact there. And that's a status quo that a lot of people don't mind leaving in place.
Mm. Also, it leads to the tragedies like we saw in Victoria, Texas.
Absolutely, and those are ongoing daily, and you're referring to the trailer that was packed with people. About half of them died. I don't remember the exact numbers, but something like 90 people in there, and about 45 of them died in the heat of Texas being smuggled in this trailer. I deal with it in the book and talk with the brother of one of those who died. He was also in the trailer. And this is an ongoing occurrence, usually not in these kinds of numbers, so that it doesn't attract the kind of attention that allows us to remember a city name and a particular event. But every day, a couple here, a couple there, all along the border, and many of them undocumented as deaths, just as they are undocumented as immigrants, so that we don't have statistics on their deaths in the middle of the desert in isolated places, where the Border Patrol, rather than being the enemy that they're trying to evade, becomes the life-saving friend. And there are poignant stories of Border Patrol men and women saving lives. Even that border resident I was telling you about earlier, who sits in his living room watching television with a gun by his side, helps people as they stagger into his yard, dehydrated and hungry. And the human aspect of the human tragedy aspect of this chaos is something that we certainly ought to be addressing, and not just looking the other way because it's 1,500 miles south of Champaign-Urbana, or whatever the exact mileage figure is.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Peter, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure, Celeste. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this.
Peter Laufer has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Wetback Nation, The Case for Opening the Mexican-American Border. The publisher, Ivan R. D. It is 1:53 Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures trading quietly all day at the Board of Trade. That in wait of Thursday's morning's USDA prospective plannings report and the quarterly grain stocks reports, which will be released at 7:30 a.m. on Thursday morning. Be sure to tune in to AM 580's pre-opening market report at 8:50 to get a complete look at those numbers. And as always, we'll try to get those numbers out to our subscribers on the Ag e-letter list as soon as we possibly can. That'll happen, I'm quite certain, long before we get to the 8:50 report that morning. Now let's take a look at what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade in the wheat pit for the day. Fairly quiet trade, a penny and a half lower in the nearby May contract, a high today of 341. The low at 334, settlement price there, half above that at 334 and a half. Once again, that May wheat contract in the futures down a penny and a half for the day. July futures, 349, the high, the low at 343. Settled at 343 and a half, they were down two. And September contract, a 354 and a half high, the low at 348 and three quarters. September soft red winter wheat at the Board of Trade at 349 and a half settlement price, down a penny and three quarters. December contract, $3.62 the high, the low at 358. Settled 358 and a quarter, they were off three quarters, and the March futures in the wheat pit were up a half. The only gainer for the day, 367, the high, the low at 364. Settlement price there at 364 and a half. Once again, they were up one half for the day. From the corn pit, quiet trade and waiting the prospective plantings report. By the way, most are expecting U.S. seeded acres to be at 82.383 million acres. That's up from last year's 80.9 million acres. And don't forget, last year we didn't get that number until a bit later in the season. The initial report showed 79 million acres that corn were expected to be planted by farmers when they actually put darn near 81 million acres in. Let's take a look now at the May corn, 214 and a half the high. Low at 211 and a half, settlement price at 213. They were up a quarter. July, 222 and a quarter the high. Low at 219 and a half, settlement price at $2.21. They were up a half. And September futures, 227 and a half the high, the low at 225 and three quarters. Settled 226 and a half. They were up a quarter for the day. And December contract in the corn pit, 235 and three quarters the high, the low at 234. Settlement price 234 and a half. They were off a quarter of a cent. May futures, 241 and three quarters the high, low at 240 and a quarter. Settled 240 and a half. They were down a quarter. And the May corn, 245 the high, the low at 243 and three quarters. The May 2006 corn contract settled at 243 and three quarters. down a half for the day. May oats 160 and a quarter the high, the low at 157 and three quarters, settled 160 even. They're up 2 3/4. July futures, 0.75 cents higher, 152 3/4 the settlement price, with a high at 53 and a low at 51 3/4. From the soy complex now, nearby May beans, 628 1/2 the high, the low at 621 1/2, settled $6.24. They were off a penny and 3/4. July futures, 633 the high, the low at 626 1/2. Settled 629 1/4, down 2 1/4. And the August soybeans, 631 the high, low at 626, settled $6.27 1/4. They were off 1/2 for the day. September futures in the bean pits, 612 1/2 the high, the low at 609 1/2, settled on that low, down 2 cents. And the November, your new crop soybeans, 601 the high, the low at $5.97, settled 597 1/2, and they were off 3 1/2 for the day. January beans for next year, 601 3/4 the high, the low and the settlement price both at $6 even. They were off 4 1/2 cents for the day. Now the products. May bean meal, 187.50 the high, the low at 185.50, a settlement price there at 186.60. They were up 50 cents. July, a 188.80 high, low at 186.50. Settled 187.70. They were up a dime. May bean oil, 23.05 high, low at 22.80. Settled 22.87. They were up 8 cents. And the July bean oil, 23.19 the high, the low at 22.93. Settled 23.06. And they were up 9 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, Todd, mostly higher day today on the Merc, the exception, April lean hogs. April feeder cattle, 107 even the high, 106.45 the low, 106.90 the settlement, that up 75. May 105.80 the high, 105.25 the low, the settlement 105.50, that up 57 1/2. April live cattle, 90.45 the high, 90 even the low, 90.10 the settlement, that up 30. June live cattle, 86.22 1/2 the high, the low 85.70, the settlement 85.82 1/2, that up a nickel. April lean hog, 70.20 the high, 68.35 the low, 69.27 1/2 the settlement, that down 37 1/2. May, 77.35 the high, 76 even the low, 77.05 the settlement, that up 30. June, 79.90 the high, 78.65 the low, 79.42 1/2, that up $1.10. July, 77.85 the high, 76.90 the low, the settlement 77.65, up 125. May bellies, 98 even the high, 95.35 the low, 97.65 the settlement, that up 250. The Dow off 46 points at 10,440, the NASDAQ off 15 at 1978, the S&P 500 down 5 at 1169.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.